This show on 90.3 WHPC is brought to you by the Double L Tavern, located at 4 West Village Green in Hicksville. The Double L Tavern is a casual tavern with a beer selection and bar bites, plus sports and entertainment. Menu highlights include pastrami Reuben egg rolls, the Hungry Man Special, which is bacon, ham, eggs, and potato on a hero, a Texas burger, and more. Information about the Double L Tavern in Hicksville is available at 516-226-3332. That's 516-226-3332.
This show on 90.3 WHPC is brought to you by Triborough Pharmacy. Hi, I'm Barry Newman, the pharmacist at Triborough Pharmacy, which is a full-service pharmacy offering a full line of prescription drugs and over-the-counter products, Notary Public, and the DMV Vision Exam. We accept most insurance plans. Located at 3720 Ditmars Boulevard in Astoria, Queens, just blocks from the Ditmars Boulevard train station. Open Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. More information is available at 718-777-7033. Ask for Barry or Joe at Triborough.
On your radio and on your phone.
Listen anytime, anywhere with the all-new WHPC app.
Update your app today. This is WHPC HD Garden City. Available on your smart speaker.
Play WHPC.
The voice of Nassau.
Wednesday, 5 p.m., time for American Hit Radio. Right here at 90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD. I'm Tom Ryan. Heidi Morales Ryan, my lovely wife, co-host, and engineer, of course, manning the board. Doing what we do, and every Wednesday we have an album that we pick. Now, we've been, I guess I got to explain it like I always do. It was a while back, maybe a decade back, when we, actually my son came on here when he was doing a college radio station, and he picked his favorite alternative songs, I think it was songs that he had chosen. And it was a fun list. And I said, why don't you come on our show? And we basically, we'll go through the list together. When it was done, it inspired me to say, you know, maybe I should do something like that and write about it. And I could, except I would naturally do albums. So I made a list. I think Kyle's list, my son Kyle, was had a list of 50 songs. I said, I'll do it with albums, but I'll make 500 of them. Typical me. So made the list. We started airing them too. And we probably got through a certain number of them. And I realized that it was lacking, because I should also be doing 500 albums that weren't just off the beaten path. I should include popular albums as well. So we had two lists. We had 500 albums that never made the top 40 and 500 albums that did make the top 40. Mixed them up in a way that they were all arranged chronologically. So we started in January of 1955, working our way up toward the present as we arranged them as the album was, by the album's release date. And here we are pretty much now at about the halfway point. We are beyond the halfway point on the top 500. On the alternative side, not quite so much. In fact, today is an alternative top 40 album that peaked at number 212. Didn't even know it, really, that there was an album chart that went, you know, beyond 200, but this album did. And it was released, so it's, excuse me, what I should be saying is that it's number 212 on our list, so I'm misspeaking here. So out of 500, it's number 212. On the Billboard charts, it reached number 111, so pardon me there, I'm misspeaking. It was released in April of 1976, and the name of the album is the name of the band, and this is where things start to change. because the name of the band is The Ramones. Now, we've been covering an awful lot of different things from 1955 until this point in 1976. 20 years, a little bit more than that, actually, plus a few months of music history to get to this point with this show on Wednesday. And all of those albums that we've covered, and that's just pretty darn close to 500 albums, they're all 500 hours of those shows are sitting on our website. And if you listen to the station at all, you probably know where that is, on AmericanHitNetwork.com, or you can just search American Hit Radio on your favorite website or whatever you do, and it'll take you right there. But all those albums are there, and you'll see them chronologically, and you can get a feel for how it was maybe inevitable that this was going to happen. I mean, since its inception as the country's most popular musical style in 1955, rock and roll evolved and changed so much during the subsequent 20 years that it eventually became unrecognizable, at least to the 1955 version of it, bearing no resemblance at all to the roots that spawned it. At its inception, rock and roll was mostly simple, strong, riff-based music for teenagers. And as time passed, styles branched out and the music, quote-unquote, matured. But much of the original vitality of the music had gone missing. By the mid-70s, production values seemed almost as important as the music, with the scene dominated by an oligarchy of egocentric rock stars and star makers, each with an agenda that bore no resemblance to the roots of the genre. Like, could Fats Domino accept Genesis as his musical offspring? Could Chuck Berry admit any connection between himself and Led Zeppelin? I mean, what's even worse is that the audience started to split into factions. I mean, in short, rock and roll had grown bloated and unnecessarily complex. Now, I normally don't want to talk too long in the beginning, but I can afford to here because this album is by far one of the shortest albums we would ever cover. The album is less than a half hour long, and it's got 14 songs on it. So even if I talk a lot between songs, I'm still going to have a lot of time to talk. So I may as well provide myself with an adequate introduction to why this album is important as it is at this time. In 1976, the Ramones hit the reset button. It was time to throw away the pretense that rock and roll was best left to technicians and wizardly visionaries. The Ramones' debut album hit the market, and everybody who heard it had a visceral reaction, for good or bad. The album disseminated slowly, and quite honestly, the majority of listeners were horrified. They despised its Cro-Magnon simplicity, while the highly compressed recordings made it sound cheap and underproduced. Most listeners kept spinning their Doobie Brothers albums, but a small percentage of the listening audience heard the Ramones as a breath of fresh air. Slowly but surely, the stagnant rock and roll scene had been revitalized by a bunch of freaky outsiders from the boroughs of New York City. The old guard mocked them, remaining blissfully cocky and self-assured, while unwittingly fading into irrelevance. Meanwhile, the Ramones defined a new breed. Considering the animus that initially greeted them, it must have been one hell of a vindication when Spin magazine voted them the second best band of all time, after You Know Who. The stylistic difference presented by the Ramones could hardly have been more drastic in every sense. It is quite ironic that they were signed by Sire Records, which up until that moment had been ground zero for progressive British rock. In the post-hippie environment, the Ramones were anti-hippies, looking more like roughshod greasers in black leather. Musically, the album was a wall of noise with short, concise tunes played at a tempo almost locked above 150 beats per minute. Bucking the trend of longer and longer concept records, the album itself is only 29 minutes long, but contains, like I said, 14 songs. Lyrics and song titles were ridiculous. Beat on the Brat with a Baseball Bat and Now I Want to Sniff Some Glue were just two examples of their self-parodic image. But this was no joke. Blitzkrieg Bop made absolutely no sense, but the song's intensity made logic irrelevant. This was about energy, pure and simple. The Ramones were plainly outsiders who somehow managed to kick down the record industry wall intended to keep out anything so primitive. Despite poor sales, critics loved the Ramones almost immediately. And in the wake of this album, punk came to life as a force to be reckoned with. For the time being, rock and roll was saved. So where does it begin? With a song called Blitzkrieg Bop. The song itself was one of the singles that was released to promote the record, and it failed miserably. It didn't do very well. It was written by Tommy, actually the drummer, and when he wrote it, it was called Animal Hop, but Dee Dee thought that that was too stupid, so he changed the wording and the name, and he gave it sort of a Nazi concept, which you'd think, say, how can that possibly be cool or get or go over? Tommy thought the song was going to be fun with a song about kids going to a show and having a good time. But Tommy decided to basically play with it in his own way by turning it into a song about a blitzkrieg. But it still sounds fun with Joey screaming, hey, ho, let's go. It ended up being like this mashup. And it worked brilliantly. All 2.5 minutes of it. Here's Blitzkrieg Bop. That's about average for the song length on the album. So that's what I've got to be doing, as much talking as we're going to be hearing music. Now, the next track is called Beat on the Brat, and apparently written by Joey. Joey said that it had its origin, said that it was, had to do with like something that he had witnessed in upper class New York City with a really bratty kid, where a mother was going, literally saw her going after her kid with a baseball bat in his apartment building lobby. But when he told the story, this is his exact quote. "When I lived in Birchwood Towers in Forest Hills with my mom and brother, it was a middle class neighborhood with a lot of rich, snotty women who had horrible, spoiled brat kids. There was a playground with women sitting around and a kid screaming, a spoiled, horrible kid just running around rampant with no discipline whatsoever. The kind of kid you just want to kill. You know, beat on the brat with a baseball bat, just came out. I just wanted to kill him." So, yeah, there you go. Very simple. Straight to the point. Beat on the brat. 2 minutes and 30 seconds later. Bam. Eventually, not a hit, but a classic punk tune.
Beat on the brat, beat on the brat with the baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. Beat on the brat, beat on the brat, beat on the brat with the baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. What can you do with a brat like that? Oh, it's on your mom. What can you lose? What can you do? What can you do with a brat like that? Oh, it's on your mom. What can you lose? Beat on the brat, beat on the brat, beat on the brat with the baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. Beat on the brat, beat on the brat, beat on the brat with the baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. What can you do with a brat like that? Though it's on your mom. What can you lose? What can you do? What can you do with a brat like that? Though it's on your mom. What can you lose?
All right, so how do they eventually even get discovered in the first place, right? I mean, if you're a band that just is like, look like a bunch of like street urchins and you're playing in small ratty clubs, how could this happen? You can credit one woman really in particular gets a lot of credit for good reason. Her name is Lisa Robinson. She's a music journalist. Got the job, but she pretty much got the job because her husband had that job and said, why don't you come and do this with me and, you know, take over a column that I had. They were British, I believe. And she started writing for English magazines, you know, like NME and things like that. Eventually worked for, you know, saw a lot of different bands in that capacity. She was actually touring with the Rolling Stones in 1975, but she found herself in New York around that time, downtown, covering the music scene. And it was her, Lisa Robinson, who was downtown and seeing the Ramones numerous times at either CBGB or Max's Kansas City. And she was just totally amused by them and really into them, who found it to be really exciting, high-energy music. Great for dancing, you know, good, great live stuff. So She started writing about them in some of her magazines, magazines like Hit Parader and Rock Scene. And this really began to get the band some attention. Joey Ramone, here's his quote. Lisa came down to see us, and she was blown away by us. She said that we changed her life. She started writing about us in Rock Scene. Then Lenny Kay would write about us, and we started getting more press like that in the Village Voice. Word was getting out, and people started coming down. Eventually, people, you know, convinced that the band needed a record contract, Lisa Robinson contacted Danny Fields, who was the same guy who was managing Iggy Pop and the Stooges, and she said, you got to come down and hear this band. You got to manage them. He came down and was like, you're 100% right. This is perfect for me. So they had everything that he liked about music. I mean, if you come from Iggy, this makes sense, right? So he ends up taking the band in and saying to do a demo. And one of the songs that they recorded in the demo happens to be the next track on the album called Judy is a Punk. That song is short enough to be a commercial. It's like 90 seconds long. Unbelievable. But that's one of the things that they recorded as a demo, right? And the producer for the demo was a guy named Craig Leon. And they somehow managed to bring this to Seymour Stein at Sire Records. And what's really interesting is that Seymour Stein's wife at the time, Linda Stein, really liked it. So she got on the bandwagon of convincing Seymour to hire the Ramones, even though at that point in time, he was busy hiring like European bands, I think like Tangerine Dream and stuff like that. Nothing at all remotely close to what the Ramones were about. So Craig Leon, Tommy Ramone, who, by the way, we interviewed here on this show about 10 or 12 years ago. That's probably on the website somewhere, too. I should bring that up, find that. But anyway, Tommy said that Craig Leon is the one who got assigned single-handed. He, you know, brought down the vice president and all these people. He was the only hip one in the company. He risked his career to get us on the label. So one of the songs that they recorded at that demo was Judy is a Punk. The other one was I Want to Be Your Boyfriend, which became the second single that they released to promote this album. And that also flopped miserably as a single, but it's also still a really amazingly cool song that promotes this album, which is now considered to be one of the best albums that was ever released by anybody ever. Here's I Want to Be Your Boyfriend.
Can I say? Because friends that want to be your boyfriend. Hey, little girl, I want to be your boyfriend. Sweet little girl, I want to be your boyfriend.
Tommy, the band's drummer, wrote that one. You know what inspired him? I should have known better with... That's the song that he said he was had it in his head when he was writing it. It's the slowest song on the album, tempo-wise, for what it's worth. And that's interesting to point out because the next song is the fastest song on the album. It was inspired by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, it's a comic book. You got to remember, that's like, you know, if you get offended by the fact that they're throwing around, you know, Nazism and stuff like that, you got to remember that a lot of what this was about was basically comic book inspired. And, you know, and they're just having, you know, fun with it. So you, if you're getting offended, then you get offended too easily, I think. That's my opinion. But the fastest song on the album happens to be called Chainsaw. Remind you that you're listening to American Hit Radio on WHPC, WHPC HD, Garden City. We're playing the Ramones album, the debut album, in its entirety, and it's great fun. It's amazing that this album really didn't age. It's one of these like weird, timelessly brilliant. It was out of time then, and it's just as much out of time now. And We're still on side one. The next track up is called Now I Want to Sniff Some Glue. So, like I said, it's like a comic book thing. Dee Dee, the band's bass player, I love his quote. He goes, I really hope no one thinks we really sniff glue. I stopped when I was 8 years old. That's, oh, good. Good, Dee Dee. Tommy thinks it's a positive song. He goes, you know, we have all these songs about I don't want to do this, now I don't want to do that, so now I want to sniff some glue is a positive song. Thanks, Tommy. Now I want to sniff some glue.
Now I want to sniff some glue. Now I want to sniff the glue. All the kids want to sniff the glue. All the kids want to sniff the glue.
One, two, three, four.
Now I want to sniff some glue. Now I want to have something to do. All the kids want to sniff some glue. All the kids want something to do.
Now I want to sniff some glue. The next track up, though, is the one to end side one. It's one of those negative songs called I Don't Want to Go Down to the Basement. Now, I related to this song when I first heard it. When I was a kid, we lived in a neighborhood. Everybody lived in really, really small houses, but we had basements. And as kids, we would always go to each other's houses. And we'd, a lot of times, that's where exactly where we would be hanging out, in each other's basements. But some basements were a lot seedier than some others. And there were a lot of basements. Like, I remember one in particular where the family had a dog and they did not walk that dog enough. That was quite obvious. And they had a pool table downstairs. So my friend would always say, let's go downstairs and play pool, man. And we'd have to like walk between puddles and watch where we stepped because there was just dog poop all over the place. It was a nightmare to go down there, as if it was like, you know, I know exactly what it feels like to say, I don't want to go down to the basement. I think that when they wrote the song, though, to them, it was more like the same sort of a thing, like a horror movie thing, like Chainsaw. They were coming up with like thinking like, you know, some horrible things can happen in basements. So that's probably what's going on in their own heads. I don't want to go down to the basement.
Thank you.
something's down there. Believe it or not, that's the longest song on the album by a matter of about 15 seconds. Debbie Harry had her own theory about that song. She said that she thinks that it's about the bathroom at CBGB. Now we flip the record over to side two. I think I'm going to make it. I'll just do a little bit less talk and we'll get all seven songs in pretty easy. First up is Loudmouth, like me. There's a lot of stuff in this album that like made me flash back to when I was a kid. Like this next track called Havana Affair. There was a, you know, Mad Magazine. You know, if you remember Mad Magazine with What Me Worry and Alfred E. Newman. There was a guy named Antonio Projas who did a whole like cartoon thing called Spy Versus Spy. Had no words. It was like, it was always just like pictures of a white spy and a black spy and how they would do all these stupid things. It was like, that were kind of remarkable. And this song more or less tries to capture that feel of what that was about. It's called Havana Affair. And we can let that segue into another song, which is about a relationship, the bad relationship that's not working out. It's called Listen to My Heart. We'll play them back to back.
Sent to spy on the
Listen to My Heart. That track was written by the bass player, Dee Ramone, as was Now I Want to Sniff Some Glue. And as happens to be the very next song that's coming up. And this next song is, to me, in my mind, it's the standout track on the album in that it's like the red herring. It's the song that almost doesn't belong on the album. So much of the album, as you can tell, has got like a cartoonish vibe. But this song, there's nothing cartoonish about it at all. It is essentially an autobiographical story of Dee Dee writing about how he was like essentially working as a male prostitute to make money by going up to 53rd and 3rd to turn tricks so that he could like basically get enough cash because he didn't have a job and that's what he was doing to make money. So he writes this song and as a way to pretty much prove that he wasn't a homosexual in the song, he kills his customer in the song. You know, Dee Dee was asked about it and his words are this: the song speaks for itself. Everything I write is autobiographical, and written in a very real way. I can't even write. What he means is he doesn't really have the imagination to write a song that he's making up. He can only come up with what he knows that he really knows in his head. So that's what makes this totally different, in my mind, to everything else that's on this album. In a way, it's a pretty scary tune. I don't believe that Dee Dee killed anybody. I think that part he did make up. And the thing is, it also freaked out a lot of the other people in the band. Danny Fields said that Johnny Ramone would never admit to knowing that 53rd and 3rd was about Dee Dee turning tricks. He wouldn't even begin to try to acknowledge that. He'd just tell you to shut up. It's not true. So whatever. But it's the way it went down. Here's 53rd and 3rd.
On the street, 53rd and 3rd, I'm trying to turn a trick. 53rd and 3rd,
know, it's obviously Joey who's singing lead on just about every single song from beginning to end, but that is Dee Dee who sings that little section at the end about taking out his knife, probably because that was the one part that he figured he really wanted to make that point known. I don't want to get into his head too deep, but like I said, there's just something about that track that makes it stand out totally, like light years away from like the rest of what this album is about. Like, for example, the song following that is almost ridiculous. I mean, it is ridiculous in comparison to that. Remember in the early 60s, Chris Montez had this like Wurlitzer organ hit that was famous around 1962 called Let's Dance, and they covered it. And they did a pretty straight version of it. So here's the Ramones doing a early 60s pop hit called Let's Dance. They overdubbed some pipe organ from Radio City Music Hall on their Wurlitzer organ to get that little sound, to make it sound a little bit like the original Chris Montez hit. All right. The next track up is the oldest song on the album. It's one of the first things that they recorded when they recorded their very first demo in early 1974. And I guess, well, since they only have 29 minutes of music on the album, I may as well put this one on there, right? As a song number 13, it's called, and it's one of those I don't wanna songs. I don't wanna walk around with you.
I don't wanna walk around with them. I don't wanna walk around. walk around with you. So why you wanna walk around me?
Wow. You realize that the only lyrics to that song are, I don't want to walk around with you, so why you want to walk around with me? That's it. That's the whole song. Now, the next song caused some trouble. They almost got axed from the record. Now, you got to remember that the guy who signed them is Seymour Stein, right? And they already got a little close to doing the whole Nazi thing with Blitzkrieg Bop, but it was kind of funny. But on this track, Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World, they took it a little bit further with lyrics like, I'm a Nazi baby, I'm a Nazi, yes I am, I'm a Nazi shotzi, you know I fight for the fatherland. And he was like, no, that's not going to go on the album. No way. So okay, we'll change the lyrics. So they change it to, I'm a shock trooper in a stupor, yes I am. Then they still say, I'm a Nazi shotzi and I fight for the fatherland. And he's like, oh, well, that's okay. So that's how the album ends. Don't ask me. It's called Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World. This was a blast. I hope you can join us next Wednesday, folks, or Friday for Hendrix if you're around on Friday, 5 p.m. See you then.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks again.